Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, December 3rd, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I also hope you had a wonderful holiday over Thanksgiving. Tonight, first money in markets, then an extended Ask Catherine. We're going to be talking about truth or consequences, once of your most voted for questions. Can you tell the truth and stay alive? And then let's go to the movies. We'll be looking, reviewing Wim Wenders' wonderful or very fascinating movie, The End of Violence. Our theme tonight is a line from Rosemary's Baby, when Mia Farrow says, "This is really happening." And I chose that because this was a week where we saw more and more people finally realizing that we're not going through a cycle in a market. We're going through a fundamental shift. One of the stories I put up on the blog was a essay by Ambrose Pritchard Evans from The Telegraph saying, it was called "China Gold and the Shift of Civilization," and he was trying to decide whether the move in the gold price was a symptom of a real shift of civilization, and I would say yes, it was. So the gold price moved up through 1,200 this week. The financial news pouring in from all around the globe was extremely negative. And what it's really describing is a global game of musical chairs as trillions of printed paper, whether it's fiat currency or bonds or derivatives, tried to reconcile with the limited number of real things. And as that happened, economic activity continued to spiral down. We had a debt crisis in Dubai, Dubai World seeking a restructuring. And as a practical matter, really just informing their creditors there would be a restructuring. Vietnam and North Korea devaluing the dollar continued to be off, nowhere near the all-time low, but certainly the last 15-month low. And the U.S. debt is approaching its statutory limit with a couple of very interesting comments that the U.S. debt clock has now gone over the statutory limit, although the debt clock uses a different count, not everything in the legal definition. But it'll be interesting to see if we get if there's going to be any brouhaha around getting that limit changed. We are watching a fundamental shift, and one of the problems is the bailout policies that we're dealing with in either Europe or China or the United States are not just affecting people in those countries. It's affecting the whole global system. And so we're watching savers worldwide, whether it's a saver in North Korea or Vietnam, literally getting their savings wiped out as the printing press continues to try and print their way out of the sort of the imbalance, which, of course, you can't do because the problem to begin with is we have a financial system that's at war with the real economy. So, printing is not going to solve the problem. The Financial Times had a very interesting opinion piece, which I posted on the blogs, which cautioned against a devaluation that spirals into trade wars, which is absolutely a possibility. And it's just a reminder that fundamental economics really matter. Not surprisingly, the financial insecurity inspired more expensive force. The president committed this week to send another 40,000 American troops to Afghanistan. The shock of that decision is reverberating through the networks that elected him. I'm still shocked they're shocked. It represents an extraordinary lack of clarity about who and what is engineering the values of our personal assets and investments, and what's going on politically. And the time has really come where we're going to be forced to, one way or another, integrate the assumptions that stand behind our investments and integrate them with the assumptions behind our expectations for U.S. government and military policy. The reality is that the U.S. military-industrial complex is deeply committed to the control of Eurasia. That includes the enormous defense contracts and purchases coming from the Afghan occupation, as well as the cash flows coming from the opium trade and the continued encirclement of Russia. If you didn't listen to our interview with William Engdahl last month, I really recommend that as a great discussion of what's going on. And one of his latest books is really, if you want to drill deeper and understand the phenomena of what's going on in Eurasia, I strongly recommend his work to you. I wrote one of my sources this week to ask them who was funding and arming the Taliban. He wrote back and said the CIA. Always a skeptic, I called someone in Europe for a second opinion. They said, of course it's the CIA, which is to say the situation is quite murky, particularly when the rumors allege that the laundry lines go through Baghdad, which is now part of the New York Fed District, and Dubai. So the bottom line, the real plan here is for a long-term occupation, and it is very unlikely that Obama is the decision maker or has much choice ultimately in this matter. One of the things that's most concerned me about the situation in Afghanistan and the recent news is a comment that was made recently by Newt Gingrich at the National Press Club saying that if the American people did not get on board to support this war, that we would find ourselves being attacked on our own soil. This weekend I heard the same comment coming almost verbatim from local Republican networks. Now, we're 4 days away from the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, December 7th, and Pearl Harbor was the day when thousands of Americans died because we thought it would be a good way to galvanize popular support for a war by not stopping the Japanese. Now that the president has announced we're sending in another 40,000 troops, let's pray for a calm day next Monday, free of clever tactics to galvanize popular support. According to Rasmussen polls, only 25% of adults surveyed support Ben Bernanke's reappointment as Fed chairman. Apparently, Congress doesn't care. As Ben testified on his reappointment today, the clear indication was he would be approved. Bernie Sanders from Vermont says he's going to put a hold, which would then require a 60 Senate vote, a senator vote. While Ben was being grilled in the Senate for his anticipated reappointment as Fed chairman, Zira Hedge pointed out that the latest emergency claims for unemployment insurance were up dramatically. Let me just read you from their blog post. I'll give you the full Tyler Durden frustration with CNBC. Even if CNBC, which seems to be unaware it is now under news ownership and can stop selling GE stock all day, every day, will Cramer be allowed to pump the worthless equities of competitor cable and satellite companies going forward? Inquiring minds want to know. Could not stop praising the fabulous improvement in continuing claims. This is continuing employment claims, which plummeted by a whopping 5,000 from 462 to 457,000. One number that everyone ignored is the explosion in emergency unemployment compensation. Yes, the same name for insurance benefits as they roll beyond their standard expiration horizon, in which the administration is set on extending to cover a period from now to infinity. That number skyrocketed by 265,300 in 1 week to an all-time record of 3,859,533 for the week ending November 14th. From 3,594,253 in the prior week. What is happening with unemployment and what is happening with the continuation and extension of unemployment is possibly the most important phenomena now occurring in our country. And it is, and I shouldn't just say this country because it's occurring all over the world. And what is important to understand is we are on our own on this, and it is contingent on us to figure out how we can start to create employment and income in our communities and networks around us. And so think of it as an opportunity. But employment is growing, and it's going to continue to grow. Anyway, Zero Hedge is fast becoming one of the most popular financial blogs. As I said before, they're committed to outing CNBC, Cramer, Kudlow, all those guys. And recently pointed out that the CNBC viewership was down over 50% from the prior year in October. Now, that goes to show you that something is working. If CNBC is down over 50%, Zero Hedge is up, I'm sure, much more. So it appears the truth is becoming more popular. Our hero this week is Mark Pittman. As more and more people appreciate the role that the Fed and its member banks have played in causing their incomes to fall and unemployment to rise, the Fed has been under attack. The effort that many of us are most aware of is Ron Paul's efforts to require an audit of the Fed. One effort which has been very important, although a bit more quiet, has been the lawsuit that Bloomberg has brought against to hold the Fed accountable. Bloomberg tried to achieve disclosure through Freedom of Information Act on where the bailout money is going. When they were unsuccessful, they've sued. The lawsuit was in response to efforts by reporters, Bloomberg reporters Mark Pittman and Craig Dorries. In August of this summer, a federal district judge sided with Bloomberg. The case was appealed. The appeal was scheduled to be heard in January. However, this last week, Mark Pittman just died unexpectedly at the age of 52. I must say I find the timing of his death to be a remarkable coincidence and hope that Bloomberg continues the efforts. Mark's courage appropriately brings us to the main topic of this evening, which is part of Ask Catherine, Truth or Consequences. About 2 months ago, one of the subscribers posted on the card the question, how do you tell the truth, and he or she said, and not get killed. And so I started several Solari reports ago, to talk through what I felt was not so much my system, which has been very emergent, of how do you tell the truth and stay alive. Because what, you know, the way I've discovered what I've discovered or what I've learned is to just try as best I can to tell the truth and to be useful. And it wasn't clear to me whether or not I would stay alive. And, of course, you know, I can only speak for up till today. Tomorrow's another day. But in the process, I found a lot of principles that I thought would be useful to you in your life. And so I want to focus not so much on the system of what I do and how I do it, but the principles that I've found useful to me that I think would help you and what I've seen help my colleagues and other people who struggle with wanting to really know what's going on in this world and living in a world where not everybody does want to know or has very divergent opinions on what's going on. So I've divided this kind of up into 12 principles. For the last several Solari reports, we talked about several of them, and I'll just quickly repeat the first three that we've already covered. One is to appreciate that you don't know the truth. When I started litigating with the federal government in 1996 and 1997, I had hoped that I would be able to settle things relatively quickly, and when that didn't happen and I realized I had to dig in for the long term, I started to write and do radio shows and go public. And what I found was by being more visible and being more public and telling what I knew about the corruption, I was really putting down simply several pieces of the puzzle on a jigsaw puzzle, which had many more pieces that I had no idea of, wasn't aware of. And I was amazed to discover how ignorant I was of so much that was going on. And it was really a very humbling process. And I really changed to a mode of really, rather than telling the truth of the corruption I knew, into trying to network with people who were seeing different pieces of the puzzle, building a map, and then really coming up with real solutions. And for a long time, much of that revolved around understanding how the federal credit was organized and how the covert monies worked in combination with the federal credit to provide this sort of global taxation system that I've described through the U.S. dollar and treasury securities. And there was a group of researchers, and it really took until about 2004, I think, or 2005, when we published a series of big pieces on the black budget, that I felt like, okay, I really have a map of how the game works. So it's made me a much more humble person, and I appreciate that there's a lot I don't know to many of the most important questions I always have to answer with I'm uncertain. I try and frame things, but I found that it is really important to stay very humble and to respect other people's opinion of what's going on, because we each have a piece of the truth. And so it's not important to insist that our point of view is necessarily the right one or more important to the whole state of affairs than maybe it really is. The second principle is one you've all heard me talk a lot about, which is the red button story. And it really describes the double bind that many of the people in the government and in the corporate bureaucracies literally live in every day with living with a group of people in America who we want to think we're wonderful people and good people, and yet we're perfectly happy when asked if we would push a red button to stop all our narcotics trafficking in our community or neighborhood tomorrow. You know, we won't push the button because we don't want our mutual funds to go down. We don't want our government checks to stop, et cetera, et cetera. And that's part of the dynamic that's gotten us so financially dependent on organized crime and literally criminal enterprise. So it's, you know, on one hand, if we insist we want to have a currency that is subsidized way above economic value and we want cheap access to all the natural resources all over the world, it is the height of hypocrisy to then say we're against the war in Afghanistan or against the war in Iraq, because in fact we're talking about an economic system which has to be backed up with force and has been for 500 years. It's what I keep calling the central banking warfare model. And so it's very, very important when you talk about what's going on that you hold the wider system responsible, because the central banking warfare model has been with us for 500 years. Every one of us is, or almost every one of us is probably sitting on land that one of our ancestors or some ancestor of, you know, the person we bought it from got by genociding the Indians or somebody else who was already here. So let's not be hypocritical about how we got here and the source of many of the blessings that we've had. And let's take responsibility to look through how the finances and the governmental policies really work and start figuring out ways of turning the red button green. So I think the more we understand the red button story and try and integrate our different complicity with what's happening, it softens the process of telling the truth, and it lessens the extent to which offense is taken by those who feel like they are legitimately in a double bind. The third principle that I discussed in the last Solari report was be useful. I often see people who started to realize that the reality is different than the official reality that they've, you know, learned as a child and grown up with, and they start to realize for everybody it's different. It could be a medical experience that causes them to realize, well, maybe vaccines aren't really safe, or they look up in the sky and they say, well, you know, what's that spraying going on, and they get on to the internet and start to realize there's this thing called chemtrails and it's really a problem. You know, everybody has a different avenue where they decide that the matrix is not necessarily the full picture of reality. And the first thing that happens is they all immediately want to share this enormously wonderful discovery and tell everybody around them what's really going on. They love their family and their friends. They want to warn them. They want to clue them in. And they walk into a force field of people who have no desire to share that information. And so you have this real question of, well, you know, how can I interact with people if you remember the wonderful scene in The Matrix where he takes the blue pill, and the red pill is you stay in the Matrix. The blue pill is, you know, you leave the Matrix and learn how things are really working. And a lot of us have to go back and forth, so I live part of my life outside the Matrix, and other times I go inside the Matrix, and we have to function in a variety of different places. And it's important to realize that the truth is great, but it is essential to be useful. And we need to use our knowledge. My knowledge of how things work, to me, it's only here to serve the people I love, the people I work for, the people I choose to serve. And my goal with that knowledge is to be useful, is to help them accomplish their purpose. Not my idea of what their purpose should be. It's their idea of what their purpose should be. And the goal of this knowledge is to help them achieve their purpose in whatever manner they seem, so or they think. So it is essential to be useful, and I think we all have an ethical obligation to use our knowledge in a way that's useful. I told the story, the last on the Solari Report, of my cousin Jane, who's she and her husband are cotton farmers. There's no harder job in the whole world than being a small farmer trying to keep a small farm going. She came into my house last year and she said, "I've got it. Here's how we do it. Just tell me what I'm supposed to do. Don't tell me why. Don't tell me how you know. I don't want to know what's really going on. Just tell me what I need to do, and I'll do it because I've learned you understand what's going to happen next. So that's how we're going to do it, but I don't want to know why." Now, let me just give you, let me jump ahead. So the bottom line is it's very important, if you want to tell the truth, to use the truth in a way that serves the goal of who you're telling it to, or the goal of what you're up to. So make sure, you know, that truth is in the service of building real wealth and building up the good guys. And if you do, then you will attract people who are also interested in doing the same thing, which is building real wealth. And, you know, truth needs to be in the service of something positive. Okay, principle number 4, take the time to understand what increases and reduces risk for other people. What I find is the key to using truth effectively and the key to being exercising discretion when you're communicating the truth is to really understand the risk issues of the people that you're speaking with or the person you're speaking with. And let me talk about a couple of what I call inflection or liability and points that are really important. One is current transactions. If people are in the middle, or an enterprise is in the middle of a current transaction, so if they're in the middle of a stock offering, if they're in the middle of a merger, dumping out information that is negative on them is going to have a much bigger impact at that inflection or liability point than it would otherwise. So let's say there's a current appointment. So Ben Bernanke is up for reappointment as chairman. He and the Fed are going to be much more sensitive to issues related to the Fed. So the Bloomberg lawsuit is going to be much more sensitive right now because of that reappointment process is leaving him insecure and is leaving a variety of players in and around the Fed insecure, including possibly the Secretary of the Treasury. So you have an inflection point. It's a point that creates liabilities for all sorts of different players. People get more sensitive. The TARP Inspector General just reamed Geithner and the Treasury for some of the variety of things in and around the bailout. I've described it up on the blog. So the Bloomberg lawsuit becomes ever more sensitive. So that's an example of understanding the impact that you have at different points of time. Finally, legal liabilities and statute of limitations. It is very important to understand the legal liability that's created when you bring out the truth on a subject, particularly if it's a subject that is where the statute of limitations isn't up. So, for example, the statute of limitations on murder, there is no statute of limitations on murder, is my understanding. And what that means is illuminating somebody's role in a murder 10 years hence or 11 years hence is much more sensitive than illuminating somebody's role in a RICO conspiracy, where the statute of limitations is probably going to be about 10 years. Whenever you're involved in any real risk issues of these kinds, particularly that involve legal liabilities, it is exceptionally important to have impeccable and very serious documentation. I first really explored the role of telling the truth when we built the first website for the litigation that my last company, Hamilton Securities, did with the federal government. What happened was we were in the courts in one form or another from 96 until 99, and literally nothing we did. We had reached the point where I had spent about $6 million on lawyers and subpoena production, and being a good soldier and kind of working in the system. And I finally realized that nothing we did was ever going to work because the whole process was just completely rigged. There was no law in our case. And so a team of us, we had two lawyers and a couple people doing the clerical and systems work, and then another group of us writing, and we spent 4 months, and we literally put thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of legal documents up on the web. We put up the docket, which is the document that describes all the different filings chronologically in a case, and then we put up a big summary of everything that had happened. You know, these situations get overwhelmingly complex. And then we hyperlinked to all the different documents. We put up chronologies of everything. We tried to do everything we could to make it simple. We launched the website. For the first week, everybody reading the website were all the different law firms and government agencies involved. And then it was 1 to 3 weeks, we had a dramatic shift in what had happened. I won't bore you with all the details, but what I realized was they were very much impacted by the transparency of making the whole situation accessible to everyone. And it wouldn't surprise me if simply getting it all digested and organized that way helped a lot of the people involved on the other side really see what was going on. But it could never have worked unless we had extraordinary documentation. And it's not our nature, unless we're involved in litigation or a professional reporter, to prepare and organize that kind of documentation, but it's important. I'll give you another example. When I wrote the story Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, I really realized there was a tremendous need with all the people I was dealing with to have one story that would bring together a couple of elements. One was to understand the relationship between the stock market and all sorts of government policies and contracts, and to see how people created an incentive system to implement a very uneconomic policy goal, but in a way you could engineer it so you could make money in the stock market, for example, and putting lots of people in prison. And there was a relationship between how the stock market traded and the laws and rules that got passed in Washington. And people needed a case study like we used to have in business school that said, you know, here's how it's engineered, and walked you through all the different numbers and the different people so that you could see it in a very concrete, sequential way. The other thing is that they needed a story where they could see the relationship between all these different sectors in the economy in sort of one integrated story. Because if you're a financial person, you really see the cash flows. The cash flows move between industries very quickly, and there's a lot of sort of dynamic relationship between the finances of many different things that people who are not used to looking at big portfolios or federal credit or government investment wouldn't naturally see. So I wanted something that showed both. To do that, I had to bring together lots of information that was very, very sensitive and describe, you know, very specific, powerful people in very, and make them public in ways that they'd never been. So I wrote it, I had an attorney edit the whole thing very carefully. I read books on libel law and then went back and re-edited it again and again and again until I made sure that it was impeccable. And then we did another thing, which was an idea that I'd been taught by Gary Webb, who wrote Dark Alliance, when he was working at the San Jose Mercury News. When he broke the Dark Alliance story, he put up thousands and thousands of pages of the documents behind his story. And when the San Jose Mercury News finally took the story down, because of pressure, saying, well, maybe it wasn't true, so many people, a lot of the minority radio stations and papers, downloaded all the documents, and the documents were irrefutable. And so so no one could ever completely isolate him on that story. He was able to bring out a book. But the documentation spread far and wide. So I put up tremendous amounts of documentation. If you go to dunwalkie.com and you go into the resource section, there's just, you know, it's on and on and on and on and on, and it's the highest quality documentation behind all sorts of allegations of corruption over the last 20 years. And it made an enormous contribution to that story coming out in a way that was not only safe for me, but I think very useful for many different people and productive. But the documentation and the care with which we did it was just essential to making it effective. And then finally, the last thing was there was really no effort. You know, I tried to be very, very fair to the people involved, bending over backward to be kind, because many of these people were people I worked with that I had liked and respected. So I wasn't trying to be harmful. I was trying to show us how we were all part of something that was becoming increasingly, we were basically making money from engineering each other's failures. So anyway, it's very important when there are real legal risks and liabilities involved to take much more care, and that's the kind of level of care that I don't take on everything I write, in the sense that I can't afford to, you know, put thousands of hours of work behind it and hire lawyers and put up documentation, which is why many of the pieces I write are opinion pieces or very short pieces. But if you're hitting one of those inflections or risk points, it's very important to take great care and to document carefully. Okay, principle number five, always assume that people are smart, not stupid. You'll see a tendency when we get frustrated with what's going on and we get depressed about what's going on, we'll start to accuse other people of being stupid, or the American people are stupid, why aren't they doing anything? And it's important to understand that that's not, first of all, that's not true, and second of all, it's not going to get us to solutions. Start by assuming people are smart, and then work to understand why they're behaving the way they're behaving. So let me give you some fact patterns. Many people in America have not been able to fathom what is really happening. Now, I think when I said earlier that gold went through 1,200 and we're coming into a real shift, I think one of the big shifts is people are starting to fathom that it really is happening, and that's why I said the line from Rosemary's Baby, this is really happening. But it's been exceptionally hard. I'll never forget, and some of you have heard me tell the story before, of a wonderful person here in Hickory Valley when I gave them a copy of Insight magazine with a cover story about DynCorp engaging in sex slave trafficking in Eastern Europe by a group of basically a U.S. government contractor engaged in sex slave trafficking on site. And after that story had been sent, Insight magazine at the time was sent to every member of the House and Senate for free, complimentary copies on their desks. The following week, big contracts were approved by both the Navy and the State Department for DynCorp. And someone here said to me, you know, I can't fathom that our congressman at the time, Ed Bryant, would know this and let this happen. She just couldn't fathom that was true, but it was. So sometimes it's important to understand that people really can't fathom. Two, they may be afraid. There is much more fear in America. You used to always hear, say, before 1990, a lot of people would say, hey, it's a free country. You never hear that anymore because people know it's not a free country. There's an extraordinary amount of fear on a variety of issues, and that's important. There's a wonderful book called Political Ponerology, which I review on the blog, and it talks about the ability of people who literally are psychopathic to get together, organize, and build political power. And the reality is, in politics, globally, we have people who are that way. They are psychopathic in approach. It's important, if you're going to tell the truth, to learn to spot them, avoid them. They're fabulous at lying. They think it's quite okay to lie. They're very, very good at it. And essentially, if you want to get in a squabble with them, then you have to understand a lot of people are afraid and they're not going to want to be involved and they're not going to want to hear your truth about the whole matter. Number three, within that, assume people are smart. Another fact pattern, you're a stranger. And sometimes we find ourselves in a situation, somebody doesn't know who we are, they have no reason to trust us. There's an awful lot of, if you don't know what COINTELPRO is, you want to take a look at COINTELPRO, just look it up on Wikipedia. There's an awful lot of people paid by a variety of different groups, including the government, to run around and tell truths and encourage people to say and do things and get involved in activities which are not healthy ultimately for them. And if somebody's a stranger and they don't know you, then they don't want to discuss something with you that might attract or bring risk to them. Okay, another is they could just be playing a game. There's a remarkable number of people. They're in every organization. They're in every neighborhood who say, hey, here's the game. This is the way the winds are blowing. I'm happy to promote the official reality if it helps me, if it makes more money in my business, if I can get promoted. Tell me whatever the tune is, and I'm happy to sing it. And they're definitely those people. They're happy to kind of go along with the psychopaths. It is what it is. So they don't want to engage in the truth, and they're probably not your best choice for conversation. And then finally, you've got a whole world of people who are unbelievably busy. They have a life to lead, and they've just decided to turn those issues over. In Christendom, we call it turning it over to the Lord, or, just turning it over to the great beyond. Now, one of the challenges in their position that they're busy is, and this is partly a short-term versus a long-term trade-off, the more we quickly face what's really going on, the faster we move to action. A little story is I was procrastinating on building orchards, planting orchards here in Hickory Valley, and I have a sustainability dinner that I go to. And there was one person who was just really in your face, aggressive. We all have to face the fact that the food supply isn't safe. We've got to do this. It takes 5 years, so you've got to plant now, blah, 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 blah. She really beat us up and put the fear of God into us. And it was, at the time I was feeling pretty beat up, but sure enough, I planted the orchards, and I'm really glad she did it. So there's there's this challenge between the short term and the long term, and we need to find that balance between being inspired to change by the truth and just rejoicing and consolidating without having the truth kind of beat us up today. Okay, principle number six, because a lot of this comes down to telling the truth, telling the truth where and to whom and when. If you're working or dealing inside the matrix, I think it's very important to practice incredible discretion or withdrawal rather than confrontation. So I would be very careful about telling the truth if you're working in a large corporation, a large government agency. If somebody's paying you to do a job, then you have an obligation to give them energy if they require you to behave in ways that you find offensive. Then the best thing is to leave. Simply telling the truth in the situation may not be productive. You have to understand many organizations are large. They're dependent on the sort of official system, particularly the capital flow, which is for all of us now is dirty money. It makes them fragile. They can't afford to give offense. They can't afford to hire and pay people who then turn around and give offense. A perfect example is if you drill in and listen to any of the stories of really terrific reporters who've been censored or even killed, you'll hear it again and again. There's April Oliver was a very successful reporter and producer who did a sarin gas story that was censored, and she found herself fired, I think it was from CBS. And when you went through the whole story, what was happening was that the military runs the satellites and the high speed feed that the media was depending on was threatened if they didn't play ball on the sarin gas story, and so there was no way that the you know, that the news network could afford to cross the military on that one. And so April woke up and found herself out of a job, despite the fact that she'd handled herself impeccably. So you need to understand the situation, the risk issues, and the agenda of who you're working with, and then you need to be very careful. Now, everybody says to me, whenever I talk about this, they say, but you're a whistleblower. You know, how could you tell us not to be a whistleblower? I wasn't a whistleblower. I was working, my company was working as a government contractor, and we were the target of a whistleblower. Oddly enough, whistleblowers are often used to, they're often used to target honest people, and it's often, the situation is often not what it seems. So, but I think being a whistleblower is a very dangerous and hard thing to do, particularly in this environment. If you have children, which I don't, and that was one of the reasons I could dig in and do what I did, it's very important to understand that your family and children are most important, and depending on the situation, they may not be safe. So, please don't waste your time trying to save a corrupt system. You know, don't try and fix the tapeworm. Use your energy to protect you and your family. So there are times and places where trying to tell the truth is just not a good investment of your time, and it won't get you to where you want to go, and it won't help change the system. Okay, principle number 7, be slow to anger. Anger creates connections with people. It took me years to understand this. When somebody first, our wonderful Peg Stewart, tried to explain this to me, and I thought, oh, well, this must be some new age thing. But it's true. Anger creates a connection with people, and that invites trouble. So if you can practice forgiveness or channel your anger in a healthy way, it's really important to get you into what some of us call right action. I was very lucky when the litigation started. I took a spiritual warfare training classes at a wonderful African-American church in Washington, Greater Mount Calvary Holy Church. And of course, that's a community that's been dealing with the war on terror from slavery on. And so there's really enormous accumulated knowledge. It's almost like being in a secret society, some of those groups, and they have centuries of knowledge and technology about how to deal with besting the tapeworm. But one of the things they taught us was that evil is a spirit that moves through the person, and what you're trying to do in spiritual warfare is separate the person from the spirit of evil and save the person. And so getting angry at the person is the least effective thing you could possibly do. And it was amazing how that training served me unbelievably well, and I just wanted to give you a couple of examples. When they seized our offices in Washington, and you have to just have this picture, here we have these beautiful offices that were designed by an architect who was very focused on advanced technology designs. We had very, very high-tech office. We'd won a big award from the Institute of the Architecture Institute on advanced facilities design. It was very beautiful. And the office was seized. We had poured all of our profits back into building wonderful software tools. The office was seized, and the FBI and HUD guys came in and just made a terrible mess for a week. It was pretty disgusting, and literally tore apart all our computers, backed up the computers, and literally we watched in a week a decade of work just be torn apart and destroyed, and in a horrible way. And so what we decided to do was we decided that it was what it was. All of our equity had been wiped out. We were going to play a game, and we were just going to assume that our opportunity now is to sell the movie rights on the story. And what we would all do for the week that we were working with the FBI and HUD to basically destroy our company was we would sort of write the plot for the movie, and we would pick out the actors and actresses who would play the different roles in the movie. And so we stopped worrying about the company and had fun writing the movie. And two of my colleagues had a big fight about who would be played by Meg Meg Ryan. They got in a real fight about who got Meg Ryan to play their part. And we just started to have so much fun. It was unbelievable. Now, by the middle of the week, they had one wonderful systems guy who was there to back up the computers who got so angry at the HUD people and the other FBI people that he literally couldn't control his temper. And our systems guy had to walk him around, take him out of the building for a walk just to calm him down. And at one point, he turned to our systems person and said, "How can you stand these people? They're horrible." And we'd reached the point where the most important FBI guy had bonded with us and not with his own colleagues. At the end, they brought in a systems consultant to help them with parts of it, came up to me and he said, "When this is all over, I want to work for you." And he gave me his card. He said, "Can I get a job with you?" And finally, we then brought in we had a wonderful company who did our facilities management called Partners in Crime. We brought them in to clean it up because it was so disgusting. I paid for it out of my own money. The property manager who had thought he was going to have to clean it up, who worked for the company we leased from, came in, saw it, and was so touched, he asked to see our lawyer, gave us an affidavit telling us that explained that they had tried to falsify evidence when they were in the building without us. We hadn't seen it. He gave us the affidavit, and it stopped an effort which literally could have put me in jail. It was quite amazing. And it all came from the fact we didn't lose our temper, we didn't get angry, and we didn't take the horribleness of the situation out on the people that we had to work through to get the job done. And it probably, you know, I can't imagine where I'd be today if I had lost my temper. So when the litigation was all over, I was sitting on the last day of the last trial. This is all civil litigation in 2004. And the last witness finished, and there were about 25 people from the government. And I turned, and they were all looking at me, and I could see they were just furious because this whole, you know, 10, 12-year effort to frame us had completely failed. And what I realized was I wasn't angry at them. I never thought about them. There was no connection between me and them. And if I'd been angry at them, I can't imagine what could have happened. You know, because if you look at the anger on their faces, we could have definitely created a connection that would not have been positive for anybody. But the reality was I saw them as much patsies in the game as any of the rest of us because, you know, the guys who were pulling the strings on this one weren't in court that day. And at the same time, what I have to tell you, it's the red button problem. As you go up the chain of command on that litigation, everybody involved was the prisoner of the model. And if anything, they were running the housing bubble, which was quite popular at the time, and they were preventing the information about the collateral fraud to come out, and which would have hit the red button. So the question was, you know, the whole thing was a tragedy that was part of a model that we're all complicit in. Okay, principle number 8, avoid the fake fights. There is a huge effort to play divide and conquer, keep people busy having fights about Democrat versus Republican, men versus women, black versus white. If you're interested in telling the truth, you need to stay as far away from all of those as possible. Every presidential election, I develop the patience of Job because I make very you know, you watch people spend $1 billion to get a Democratic candidate elected when you know that the policies are just going to pretty much remain the same. It's just going to be a different group of people sort of getting the immediate patronage. And every 4 years, my efforts to warn people that it's a deeper problem, you know, turn out to not make a difference as everybody piles in and thinks that, you know, Obama's going to make all the difference. And so, you know, that's the time when I go quiet and just put my head down and try and get as much work done on the deeper issues. But don't get into the fake fights and don't lose energy and get angry trying to push the truth in the middle of those. Stay focused on real solutions. Principle number 9, ask questions. There was great success on 9/11 by the website Unanswered Questions because we all said, look, we don't know what the truth is. So if we're going to find out what the truth is, connect the dots, build a consensus on sensitive issues, what we need to do is just ask questions and not try and answer the questions, not try and tell what the truth is. It's another way of dealing with the liabilities that I described to you that can come up. And it worked because just by asking questions and bringing different questions to the fore, it really allowed people to explore and decide for themselves. Mind control technology is very real. Some people's opinions are literally hardwired, and mind control, we'll do something on mind control in 2010, but mind control can range from anything from subliminal programming and entrainment on TV to literally the Manchurian candidate kind of programming. And literally, when you run into somebody who's in that kind of framework, it's just important to understand you can reason with people, but you can't reason with those kind of hardwired programs, and you need not to try. And that applies to a lesser extent with people who are completely financially, emotionally vested in whatever their truth is. And so you need to be careful there. Principle number 11, when you can, it's very important to support people who tell the truth. There's really a karma in if you help people who are telling the truth, it somehow always comes back around to you. And this has happened to me literally hundreds of times, but one that really is always on my heart is when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, I was ordered by the secretary, called me in his office, and there was a New York Regional Administrator who was under investigation for, it's not even important what it was, but he called me into his office and basically said, look, she needs to be found guilty, so you need to fix it. And I said, Jack, I'm not going to fix it. And I left, and after I left HUD, I called her attorney and said, look, here's what happened. I told them exactly the story. I said, feel free to call me as a witness. I'm happy to testify for you. And I came in, and the guy from the from HUD who had been a deputy of mine who was there to testify took one look at me, knew exactly what I was going to do, and I don't know how much it changed his testimony, but then I got up and testified, and of course she was not convicted of anything. That was the end of that. Now, what was very interesting is fast forward many years later, the HUD Inspector General during the litigation tried to get an auditor from the HUD IG's office to say that we were corrupt and to basically bury her audit. She refused to, left HUD, and then proceeded to come and give us a deposition explaining that essentially an illegal act by the IG to suppress her real opinion. And it was so parallel what I had done for the New York Regional Administrator, I just had to laugh, and it proved again that what goes around comes around. Finally, I think, and this is probably the most important principle I have to tell on this one, and that is the power of community and the power of prayer. The most important question in your life is not who's against you, but really who is for you. And one of the things that causes people to get into trouble by telling the truth is they allow themselves to get isolated. They stop remembering, you know, the point of telling truth is to build up community, is to build up country, is to build up our networks, is to build up a better world. And so it needs to be harnessed in the service of that, as opposed to something that's just pushed through in an isolated way. I'm a person who believes very much in spiritual powers and intelligence, and it's very important that we act in alignment with them. One of my favorite stories, I was at an investment conference in London, and one of the investment managers got up and told the story about Carl Jung, who had a patient, a young woman who'd married a much older wealthy man, and after she had married took a younger lover and couldn't reconcile her desire for her husband's wealth with her desire to be with her younger lover, and so ultimately resolved the tension by murdering her husband, and she got away with it, and then years later had the equivalent of a nervous breakdown and came to see Jung and told Jung her problem was that from the time she murdered her husband on, wherever she was, the birds would stop singing. She said the birds knew. And so I think I come back to the idea of who and what does your truth serve, and what is your plan? We can look around the world and say we hate to say what's going on. At the same time, what's our plan? I said that I thought the swine flu vaccine was in essence depopulation. And at the same time, what's my plan to deal with the population explosion? So the last comment I would say is not how do you stop from being killed, but how do you make sure that what you're saying and doing is in the service of getting us to someplace productive. And one other comment I wanted to add was, I was once told a story of a game you could play where you would write all your possessions down on different pieces of paper, and then you would go through a large mansion, in every room you had to give up one of your pieces of paper. And it was a way of kind of focusing you on what of your possessions was the most valuable. And I kind of felt over the last 20 years that I played that game in real life, because I got down to a point where I had to give up all my possessions, and then I was down to my life or freedom, and I had to choose between my life and freedom, and I took freedom. And when I say freedom to me is freedom of, freedom of the intellect, freedom of speech, freedom to really understand our world and know what's going on to me is so, so very important. And the reality is, at that moment, what I understood is death is not the worst thing that can happen. So, and there are lots of benefits that come from knowing what is really going on and being in cahoots and working with people who know what's going on and building a business where you can work with people who really want to know the truth as best we can see it and know what's going on. You know, and there are a lot of benefits that come out of that. And I have to say, the worst thing that could happen to me is not that I die. The worst thing that could happen to me is that I would wake up, you know, in 2010 in Washington being part of a group of people who's leading and doing what some of these people are leading and doing. I can't fathom how painful that would be. So I have to say I made the choice for freedom. I don't think that death is the worst thing that could happen. And at the same time, if we can tell the truth and avoid dying, that would be terrific. Now, quickly, one other question that came up, that a lot of good questions this week that I wanted to respond to was, hello, Catherine. The Solari approach seems to be quite optimistic. Even if for planning purposes only, I believe it might help Solari Report listeners if you thoroughly considered a worst-case scenario. In other words, the red button isn't turned green before an economic collapse and civil war commences. I couldn't agree more. This is a much longer question at the card. I couldn't agree more to let the person who wrote this know. We've done a whole bunch of Solari reports on sort of worst-case scenarios, two with Cliff High, one with Dmitry Orlov. If you listen to the audio seminar, Positioning Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times, I absolutely think it's essential to organize our assets and our thinking to be prepared for worst-case scenario. And what's fascinating about getting prepared for worst-case scenario is, once you do it and you shift your time and your money in accordance with a worst-case scenario, what you'll find is you're very well positioned for many of the other scenarios. So it absolutely pays. I couldn't agree with this guy more. One of the things he says is, or he or she, is that they're living abroad. There are many pros and cons of going to another country or staying here, and I'm not going to get into all of them today, but I do think it matters where you live, but I would suggest that I think there are places in the United States that are worth considering as well, because the problem we're facing is global. The move to have central control is global, and so by leaving the country, you may delay when the problem reaches you, but I think it's going to be everywhere. Okay, let's go to the movies. Wim Wenders, The End of Violence. Incredible, incredible movie. Mike Max is a successful Hollywood producer. He's kidnapped by two men who have qualms about killing him. They are mysteriously killed by some mysterious weapon that works, seems to work from high up, whether communication equipment or satellite. Mike escapes and hides out with his gardener's family. At the same time, a surveillance expert, a guy named Ray, is a computer scientist working on developing a system that tracks what is happening in the L.A., in the system for L.A., the city of L.A., Los Angeles, and it's designed to reduce crime, but when the incident with Mike happens, he realizes this is more than a surveillance system, it's a control system, and people are being killed. His effort to leak the potential abuse causes him to be assassinated by a group that looks remarkably like U.S. intelligence. Now, why did I want you to watch The End of Violence? There is so much going on with satellites and directed energy weapons that we're not going to talk about tonight. But if you talk to people about why they're afraid of telling the truth, as part of it, what you need to know is that this kind of surveillance and this kind of weaponry does exist. And it's one of the things that needs to be taken into consideration as this technology grows on a global basis. Next week, we're gonna be talking about the Royal Rife documentary. It's called Royal Rife, The Forgotten Story. I asked Netflix if they would get it. They wouldn't, so you're going to have to buy it on the Internet. It's a classic. If you want to understand the real healthcare debate and the real healthcare issues, it's a documentary that can inform you tremendously, and I strongly recommend it. Okay, so in closing, I also wanted to mention I love Christmas, and I love the December holiday season. I've already been, putting poinsettias out in the house and mailing Christmas cards, and I keep running in this year into people who are very alienated about Christmas. I keep thinking, no, the tapeworm cannot have Christmas. We're taking it back. So as you go through the holiday season, let's not let all the horrible things going on, keep from us the joy that we can have with friends and family, just celebrating that which is good in our lives. So December 10th, next week, I'm going to be doing the Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. We have a lot to talk about. What's going on in the precious metals market is very important, very significant. January 7th, we're going to have the year-end wrap-up. Send questions into the card or to communicate it. Solari, that's a very important, the year-end wrap-up is very important for me. It's where I look back and say, okay, here's what's happened over the last year, and ask the question, what's coming up? Where are we going? So until then, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.